Today, I want you to travel back in time with me, all the way to the year 2010. Now imagine, you just finished watching your favorite DVD, and you decide to fire up your brand new BlackBerry and start browsing the web. You stumble on a message board where a guy named Laszlo has just posted that he's willing to pay 10,000 Bitcoin to anyone who will deliver him two large pizzas. Would you take him up on it? Well, it took a few days, but eventually somebody did. Two large Papa John's pizzas, one supreme and one cheese, were delivered to Laszlo's front door in exchange for 10,000 Bitcoin. Now, before you laugh, those Bitcoin were only worth about 40 bucks back then. And believe it or not, that was the first ever documented transaction using Bitcoin to pay for a physical good. Now, it's celebrated every year on May 22nd and is officially known as Bitcoin Pizza Day. And Laszlo used Bitcoin exactly how its mysterious creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, intended it, as a decentralized, peer-to-peer payment system. Basically, as electronic cash. Now, I'm not sure if Nakamoto knew that Bitcoin would turn into what it is today, but I can almost guarantee you that Laszlo did not. The price of those two Papa John's pizzas now? Nearly $1 billion. Needless to say, the crypto market has exploded since 2010. Over the past 15 years, we've seen thousands of cryptocurrencies emerge. What started as a niche interest among tech enthusiasts has become a global phenomenon, creating its own language in the process. Terms like stablecoins, DeFi, and NFTs have entered the financial zeitgeist. But for most of us, cryptocurrencies and the blockchains that they reside on, well, they're still just as cryptic as Satoshi Nakamoto's identity. But that's where we come in. On today's episode, we're going to explain how it all works. Now, you guys know my kids inspire this podcast, and today's episode is certainly no exception. One of our favorite things to do together is to go to the arcade. And I actually think the arcade makes for a great analogy to explain crypto and the blockchain. Think about it. The first thing you do when you walk into an arcade is you exchange your real money for virtual tokens that are stored on a plastic card, not unlike a crypto wallet. And if you lose that card, your tokens are gone. Now, I know you're thinking, yeah, that's great and all, but it doesn't explain the volatile price of crypto. And to that, I'd say you must not have young kids. Because if that arcade has Sonic the Hedgehog merchandise behind the prize counter, the value of those tokens goes to the moon. And well, if they don't, they're basically worthless. Now, we can also use the arcade to explain the blockchain. You ever set a high score on an arcade game? Yeah, it's a great feeling, right? Problem is, the next time you go in there, it's completely vanished from the history books and nobody would ever know. I'll explain how this would never happen if that arcade used blockchain technology. And joining me today to help us all level up is Scott Muir. Scott is our digital asset topic team leader and a fellow arcade enthusiast. We discuss the different types of cryptocurrencies that are out there. We translate this new foreign language. We actually explain how the blockchain technology works. I'm Nick Tricarci, and this is By Analogy. Scott Muir, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Nick. I've been wondering what took you so long to invite me.
Well, I figured now is a perfect time with all the crypto news that's out there. I thought it might be a good idea to do an episode to explain what it is and how it all works. And Scott, I know you get a ton of questions on crypto from our clients and engagement teams, but they're not the only ones asking you about crypto. Is that right?
No, definitely not. I mean, it was interesting just a couple days ago. My 83-year-old mother, who seemingly doesn't call me other than when there's a problem. So I get a phone call, I'm nervous. She actually wants to talk about crypto because it's all in the news around the presidential inauguration. So this is my mom who can barely use Google and email, but wants to ask me about crypto.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's perfect then. Now, hopefully she can listen to this podcast and learn something. And, you know, obviously we're not offering investment advice here. It's just going to be an explanation of how this works and hopefully try to bring this out of the shadows a little bit. And Scott, in the cold open, I explained that I thought the arcade actually makes for a pretty good analogy for crypto and the blockchain. Usually I try to weave that throughout our conversation, but I think with this topic, it's best that we just dive right in. And then what I'm going to do is at the end, I'll try to recap everything using that analogy. So maybe I'll just get started. I know there's no like universal definition of cryptocurrency. at least not as far as I know. But how would you explain it to someone who may not be familiar with crypto?
Yeah, I think you're right. And at least partly because there isn't sort of a consensus definition. It's often easiest to start with some examples that probably most people have heard of, right? So, I mean, Bitcoin and Ether are the two most widely known and held cryptocurrencies. Other examples that I am sure many listening have also heard of include things like Solana, Ripple, and Litecoin. Probably less commonly thought of are what I call the stablecoin cryptocurrencies like USDC and Tether, which I think we'll get into that a little bit more here in a bit. You know, the original premise of cryptocurrencies was to create a decentralized payment system that was autonomous or independent from any single central authority or clearinghouse like a bank. However, over time, interestingly, many cryptocurrencies, and certainly Bitcoin is first and foremost at this list, have also or even primarily become an investment or store of value means versus something that's primarily used for payments.
So here's the $1 million question, or maybe the $100,000 question. I've been burying the lead a little bit here, but why is Bitcoin, and maybe you want to talk about others, why is it worth so much money?
Well, it's a fair and good question. I've been asked it by everyone from my teenage son to my 83-year-old mother I referred to before.
Yep.
The short answer is because that's what people think it's worth. Even though it's not backed by hard assets like gold, it is a finite resource. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins created based on the programming of the blockchain. So it is similar to gold in that respect. Obviously, gold is also a finite resource. I also think with respect to Bitcoin, it benefits within the crypto ecosystem from being the original. If I were to compare and contrast that, I don't think that notion of value exists for all cryptocurrencies. I think other cryptocurrencies have their value derived differently. So if I can digress for just a minute, I know you didn't specifically ask me about Ether, but just to illustrate this different angle, Ether supply is not fixed like Bitcoin's. Ether's value is instead, at least in my mind, really driven by its nature as the toll for the Ethereum blockchain. Every transaction on Ethereum incurs a gas fee that has to be paid in Ether. So a bet or an investment on Ether is really a bet on the long-term viability of the Ethereum ecosystem.
Okay, and by that you mean kind of betting on the use cases that come with using that blockchain, is that right?
Yeah, that there will be a continued evolution and demand for the use cases on the Ethereum blockchain for which Ether will have to pay the toll.
Yep, okay. And this is a good point to highlight. I mean, each cryptocurrency is different. Each blockchain is different. They all have their own protocols and, you know, rules and whatnot. And so we're talking here in generalizations. We'll probably focus most of our conversation on Bitcoin just because, like you said, Scott, it's the biggest and the original. But, you know, with that comes a lot of new terminology when we hear people talk about crypto. And I think a lot of the confusion for, let's just say, the general public comes from not understanding the lingo. So, Scott, I want to ask you to play translator for a second, and I want to throw a couple commonly used terms at you and ask you to translate them into plain English. You game?
Yep, shoot away.
All right, let's start with NFTs, which stands for non-fungible tokens. How would you explain those?
Yeah, I'm going to try to keep it pretty simple. An NFT really simply just memorializes unique data on a blockchain. Most commonly, that data that gets memorialized relates to the rights of the NFT holder. Like, for example, rights to use IP, such as to use, display, or view a character image or a video like a sports clip. NFTs can convey rights to virtual goods like a special avatar or weapon in a video game or virtual real estate in the metaverse, a term I don't think we're hearing as much these days as we were for a while. But NFTs can also serve as public record tickets to things like real-world events, like sporting events or conferences. The benefit there being security and verifiability of the ticket ownership. And really, when it comes down to figuring out the value of the NFT, it then derives from the perceived value of those rights that it memorializes.
Yeah, so I mean, basically, an NFT is kind of like just proof of ownership, right? Like you almost have title to something. And to me, the key here is that it's non-fungible, which means, you know, no two NFTs are the exact same.
That's right. I mean, I think you said it well. And again, when I referred to unique data, it's, you know, my rights that I get should be different from the rights you get, even if to a similar type of character image or clip.
Yeah. And I think one of the most famous NFTs out there is this Bored Ape Yacht Club, which I'm just going to call it like a digital painting. You know, you could call it an avatar. But I feel like this is a good example just to illustrate this proof of ownership, because we can compare it to like it's parallel in the physical world, right? Like everyone's familiar with the Mona Lisa. We all know the original is held at the Louvre. However, you can go online and find a million pictures of the Mona Lisa, or you can buy your own print copy for probably not much money at all. And the same is true for these Bored Ape NFTs. It's just that even the original is digital. So meaning whoever owns that NFT is the one sole owner of the image, even though you can find a million copies of it online. So it's a little different because obviously everyone knows the Mona Lisa in your house is fake and it's a little harder to tell when everything's digital, but I feel like this might be a good parallel for people to draw in their heads as to what we're talking about here. And that segues into another term, Scott, that gets used a lot that I want to ask you about, and that's this term of tokenization. Can you explain what that concept means?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the first thing I'll do is let's hit on the sort of the base term of token. A token is really just any digital asset on a blockchain. You know, for example, Bitcoin and Ether can both accurately be characterized as tokens, but a token can also be a blockchain representation or record of a real world asset. For example, a bond or other security can, and we are seeing this happen, be tokenized so as to be able to track it or trade it on a blockchain versus it's called an older school method.
Okay, so in my example, the Mona Lisa could, in theory, be tokenized. Is that right?
Yeah, same as a fractionalized share of a bond or a piece of real estate that would also be as unique as the Mona Lisa.
Yep, okay. All right, so let's talk about another very popular type of token. And you already mentioned it, but it's something that is referred to as a stable coin. Can you explain what a stable coin is?
Yeah, I mean, so just to bring this back full circle a little bit to where we started our conversation. Stablecoins are a type of cryptocurrency, and they are in fact often some of the most used crypto assets to make payments or transfer funds. Now, stablecoins really exist and came into use to provide value stability in a broader crypto ecosystem that's very often marked by high volatility. Now, stablecoins bring value stability by pegging the value of the stablecoin token most commonly to a fiat currency, for example, the US dollar or the euro. They're designed to track and remain pegged in value to that fiat currency. So for example, USDC and Tether are stable coins designed to have one USDC or one Tether equal $1.
Yeah, so in my cold open, I told the story of Bitcoin Pizza Day and how, you know, I said that Lazo used Bitcoin the way it was originally intended as basically digital cash. But to me, these stable coins seem a lot closer to digital cash than Bitcoin certainly is, at least in the USDC example you gave where it's, you know, it's pegged to a dollar. So, all right, I've got to ask about one last thing, which is meme coins. Those, you know, seem to be getting into the headlines more and more every day. So walk us through what a meme coin is, Scott.
Well, meme coins are also, again, to be clear, this would be another subset of cryptocurrency, but they are to me almost the opposite of stable coins in that rather than being stable in value, these are often the most volatile of cryptocurrencies, seeing often very huge swings in value in very short timeframes. Now, this is the case often because they are, you know, created as a joke or based on an internet meme rather than for a serious technological or financial purpose like many other crypto assets. Now, meme coins usually gain popularity through social media or, you know, online chat communities. They're often driven by humor or some viral trend that you can see out in the real world. But it's, you know, it's interesting. Meme coins very often go as quickly as they come, but that's not always the case. Dogecoin, for example, which was popularized originally by Elon Musk, began as a meme coin, but it's currently the eighth largest crypto asset by market cap. And Shiba Inu coin, based on a virtual pet in a video game my kids play, is number 16 on the market cap list. So both have market caps in the billions of dollars and daily trading volumes in the hundreds of millions. So I guess what I will say is that once a meme coin, not always a meme coin.
Got it. Well, I want to play a little game that I'm going to call two coins and a lie. So what I want to do here, Scott, I want to give you three meme coins, two of which are real and one of which is fake. And I want to see if you can find the fake. Does that sound good?
I'll give it a go, but it may not be hard to trick me on this one.
All right, here are the three. Number one, sad hamster. Number two, egg dog. And number three, cheddar coin.
I'm going to go with egg dog.
That one is real. Believe it or not, that one is real. The fake was cheddar coin, which I used AI to help me come up with. So, all right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about what makes this all work, aka the blockchain. All right, welcome back. I'm here with Scott Muir talking about crypto and the blockchain. Scott, we just got done explaining the cryptocurrency side of things. Now I want to talk about the blockchain technology that underpins all of these cryptocurrencies. And we kind of talked about it a little bit at the beginning of our conversation, but just to level set, what is the blockchain?
Well, to start, I mean, blockchain is a distributed ledger software technology. And it is, in fact, a chain of blocks, data blocks of transactions. You know, the name is actually quite accurate to what it is. Each approved block of transactions attaches to the one that precedes it, forming again a virtual chain of data blocks. Now, as a distributed ledger technology, a blockchain's key tenets are that it records transactions across a broad network of different computers, which again, I've referred to before in crypto space, these are referred to as nodes. And that distributed nature makes the blockchain data effectively immutable to retroactive change.
Okay, so in my words, it's basically a really fancy database or transaction log, however you want to visualize it. And it sounds like here the key is that instead of there being only one copy of that database, which you mentioned earlier could be controlled by, let's say, a single party, there's actually many different copies of this database and they're controlled by a group. So if something were to happen to one of them, there's many different backups, so to speak, so that you always have a record of what's happened. So, Scott, I know this is very nitty-gritty in terms of how this all works and how the sausage is made, but give me a 30,000-foot overview of how the blockchain technology actually works.
Let's try and walk through, to make this a little bit simple, let's walk through an example transaction. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that you, Nick, want to give me a Bitcoin, which would be great.
Yeah, if I had a Bitcoin to give you, yeah.
Hey, I'll bill you. It's an IOU. The first thing that happens is that you are going to initiate that example transaction from your crypto wallet. Now, because the blockchain is a distributed ledger that lives, as we discussed earlier, across all the nodes, a new transaction immediately becomes visible, i.e. is broadcast to all those nodes. And then the validation of the transaction by those nodes is a lot like your bank validating a credit card transaction before it's approved, but instead of being done by a single bank, it's done by the many decentralized nodes I referred to previously that make up the blockchain network.
Yeah, so they're making sure that I actually have this Bitcoin that I'm sending you, hypothetically, and that I properly authorize the transaction, right? That's kind of what's being done at this step.
Yes, those are the big ones.
Yeah, so like you said, with a credit card, you know, my bank is making sure that I've got the funds, I've got the available credit, that I was the one who, you know, initiated the transaction. It's not fraudulent, et cetera. Okay, so let's just assume the transaction gets validated. What happens next, Scott?
Well, next, the transaction is grouped with other transactions into a block, right? No block on the blockchain has just your transaction sending me a Bitcoin. It's going to be grouped with others for many reasons, including efficiency of the network. Now, the block itself now undergoes validation before it gets added to the blockchain, right? So the transaction was validated. Now the block itself undergoes validation. Now, this last step in the validation process is that the required majority or supermajority, depending on the blockchain, the rules aren't always the same from blockchain to blockchain. The required majority or supermajority of the nodes must agree that the current state of the blockchain should include this new block, because once they do, It can't be changed. Now, as you mentioned, and this has come up a couple times, this is, of course, very different from a process whereby, you know, one central authority, for example, you know, one bank, decides what transactions are or are not valid.
Okay, so at this point, we have double or maybe even triple validation. First, you got each individual transaction itself that gets validated. Then the batch of transactions that it's grouped with, aka the block, gets validated. And then on top of that, there's a vote to make sure everyone agrees that the transactions are valid. And all of that has to happen before the transaction data is logged into this database that we call the blockchain. And so our listeners might be wondering, like, why would the people operating these computers or nodes agree to go through all this and do all this work? And the answer to that question, like many other questions, is money. Because whichever node validates a block is rewarded with the cryptocurrency. For example, on the Bitcoin blockchain, if a node validates a block and therefore adds it to the blockchain, they get a reward of 3.125 Bitcoin right now, which is worth about 300 grand. And that's on top of all the transaction fees that are associated with the block. So it can be a quite lucrative endeavor. And so tying it back to the first part of our conversation, Scott, like Bitcoin and many other cryptocurrencies were really created as a way to incentivize people to do this work, to maintain the integrity and security of the blockchain. And in some blockchains, such as Ethereum, these nodes can actually be penalized if they fail to perform their duties or they act maliciously. And that penalty is usually in the form of, you know, having some of their cryptocurrency taken away, which is usually referred to as slashing. So these nodes, which you can kind of think of as like the gatekeepers of the blockchain database, are not just doing this out of the good of their own hearts. So Scott, one of the key value drivers of the blockchain technology is that it makes the data immutable, meaning once it's added to the database, it cannot be altered or deleted or tampered with. So I want to ask you to just explain why that is.
Yeah, so once the blockchain's required consensus is achieved and a block is added, that new block now has its own unique ID that is based really on two things. First, all of the transaction data that is within or built into that block. And second, the unique ID of the previous block. So now, because each new block is linked to the ones preceding it, and then any ones that come after succeeding it, any attempt to alter the records of an existing block after it's already been placed would not only change the unique ID of that block you're attempting to change, but would also change the unique ID of every block that came after it, effectively creating what's called a fork in the blockchain. And that can only occur if the decentralized nodes were to concede to it following the consensus mechanism we talked about before. So it makes it very, very difficult that you would achieve that consensus to sort of rewrite history.
Yeah. So my visual for this is like almost like a formula error in Excel, right? We've all had the formula where it's linked to other cells and then you go change one of those cells and everything goes poof and has this big formula error. So again, just hammering on the security point, right? As soon as someone were to try to attempt to change the past, it's going to immediately get detected by every computer, every node on that blockchain. And then those nodes are disincentivized to approve that change because if they approve something that wasn't legitimate, they're going to lose some of their cryptocurrency, which is worth a lot of money potentially. Before we keep going, what are the main benefits of a decentralized approach? Because this is very complicated stuff. So why go through all of this?
Yeah. And again, I'm not sure, similar to there not being a single definition of cryptocurrency, that everyone's answer would be the same here. But certainly things that people point to are an increased security and resiliency, right? There's no single point of failure or single source of truth to hack or have fail and go down. Others point to, you know, just the transparency aspect. You know, as I just mentioned about all the nodes and everybody needing to approve changes to the blockchain, it's hard to hide anything that resides independently on thousands of these nodes where anything done immediately gets broadcast to all of them transparently. Probably the last one that I'd really point to is sort of more privacy and autonomy, right? Cryptocurrency transactions can generally be anonymous on the blockchain, and there is a sort of what I term communal freedom from there being no single big brother with the power to approve, reject, or modify transactions. I guess one other thing too that some people point to is there's no blockchain holidays. The decentralization means that nodes are always operating. So because of this sort of distributed nature, the blockchain is always processing 24/7, 365 versus, you know, the traditional finance system shutting down for things like President's Day.
Yeah, and having that security and resiliency in particular is really important when we're talking about sensitive financial transactions like crypto. And Scott, our listeners have probably put this together by now, but just to be clear, this blockchain technology is really not specific to crypto. As we've talked about, it's really just a super secure database, and so it can be used to record and track all kinds of different information. For example, people have talked about using it for real estate transactions or, you know, health records, for example. All right, Scott, we've covered a lot of ground at this point, and now I'm going to try to summarize and recap everything that we've talked about using my analogy of going to the arcade with my kids. You ever go to the arcade, Scott?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that's a big thing in my family. I mean, my kids absolutely love it. I think at this point, we've been literally to every arcade in Northern Virginia. And what's the first thing you do when you walk into an arcade? You trade in your real hard-earned money for a plastic card that has virtual tokens on it, right? Like some might call it the original virtual currency. And just like with crypto, if you lose that plastic card, you're screwed. Your tokens are gone forever. Now, the other thing about the arcade tokens is that they only really work in that specific chain of arcades. So you can't take your Dave and Buster's card and go spend it at Bowlero, for example, which, as you mentioned with crypto, we said each one exists on a specific blockchain. So you can't transact in Bitcoin on the Ethereum blockchain and vice versa. Now, Scott, the reason I got the inspiration for this was actually because I realized how much volatility there is in these arcade tokens, at least in my kids' eyes. You might laugh, but the first thing my kids do when we get to an arcade is they run up to the prize counter and they scope out what's behind the desk. And I can promise you, if that arcade has Sonic the Hedgehog merchandise, those tokens are worth an illogical sum of money. And if the prize counter doesn't have anything good, well, the tokens are basically worthless. So as crazy as it sounds, it's kind of like crypto, right? It's all about demand, which is what you mentioned earlier. Now, if we get to the blockchain, I alluded to this, but think of the blockchain as like a chain of arcades. So I'll just pick Dave & Buster's as an example. Each Dave & Buster's location would be a node on that blockchain. So they're all operated independently, but they follow the same protocols. Just like how all these computer nodes on the Bitcoin blockchain, for example, run the same software protocols. Now, Scott, I actually think there's a huge opportunity for these arcades to embrace blockchain technology. Because let me ask you, have you ever set a high score on an arcade game?
No, I'm not very good, unfortunately.
Oh, really? I was going to say, if you did, there's probably no record of that, right? Like, the high scores are only maintained on those local machines. So if somebody else came along after you and beat your score, or honestly, what I think happens way more in practice, the arcade manager just resets the game, there'd be no proof that you ever were once atop the leaderboard. And to me, I just think that's unacceptable. So Scott, my claim to fame is Papa Shot. When I was a kid, the Cleveland Browns used to host player press conferences every Monday at the local Dave and Buster's. So I was in like seventh or eighth grade. Me and a group of my friends would go every week and we'd always compete against each other in Papa Shot. But what we figured out, there's like six of these machines lined up next to each other. And the more players you had at the same time, the more your tokens were worth because you could win more tickets. So we would basically go around and recruit random strangers to play us to make sure that all six machines were fully utilized. And basically we were like arcade hustlers, right? So naturally we got pretty good at it. And, you know, I'm not trying to brag or anything, but I did set a few high scores in my time. But unfortunately, you would never know it. The record books have been completely wiped. And this is where the opportunity comes in. Imagine if that arcade implemented blockchain. I think the way it would work would be something like this. And this is a very, you know, simple high level, but picture like a decentralized leaderboard. So instead of the high scores being maintained on each local Papa Shot machine, let's just say they were broadcast to all the Dave and Buster's around the country, and each location had a copy of all the high scores that were ever set. And let's just say that was displayed within the arcade so everybody could see it. Now, let me take it one step further, because obviously at this point I've established this is very high stakes, right? We cannot have an inaccurate record of Papa Shot high scores. So let's just assume every time somebody set a new high score, the local arcade manager would have to come over and validate it. You know, they've got to make sure, did that person follow the rules, or did they steal some extra balls from the Papa Shot machine next to it? Or did they, you know, try to lean over and dunk it in, right? And once that score is validated, then it gets broadcast to all the other Dave and Buster's locations and the scoreboard gets updated. So now nobody can ever change that database. They can only add to it if and when a new high score happens. How'd I do, Scott? Do you think that analogy works? What am I missing?
I think the analogy works. Whether companies like Dave and Buster's will want to invest in that technology, I will leave for their management to decide.
That is fair. That is fair. All right. Well, I thought that was a little bit more fun. You know, the normal analogy, you hear somebody try to explain the blockchain is like a notebook or something that's just a little boring. So I thought I'd try to spice it up. But Scott, I think, you know, we've covered what I wanted to cover. So I really appreciate you being here. I think we've set the high score for the number of mentions of nodes on this podcast. So that's something, right?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And I'll be awaiting that Bitcoin that you owe me.
All right. You might be waiting for a while. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, which I hope you did, please give us 5 stars and make sure you subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you listen to podcasts. We've got some really great content coming up that you will not want to miss. And in the meantime, you can check out our website at frv.kpmg.us. We've got some really great materials on whatever financial reporting topic you're interested in. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.